Happy New Year, and welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. I was watching Unsolved Mysteries. It's an American television series hosted by Robert Stack. The series was known for its reenactments of unsolved crimes, mysterious disappearances, and unexplained paranormal phenomenon. Next to Rescue 911, this was one of my favorite shows to watch when I was younger. When the series was revived on Amazon Prime, I couldn't help myself, and I had to immediately binge. I came across a case that was really interesting, and I wanted to share it with you. Of course, this case brought up another question. What makes a woman help a man escape from prison? Okay, on to the show. April 26, 2012, Greene County, Pennsylvania. 74-year-old John E. Yount was found hanging in his state prison cell. John's suicide was surprising, but not unexpected. For the past decade or more, he had petitioned for clemency. On April 26th, he had finally given up his fight. When John's death was publicized, many people had never heard of him or his crimes. John was born in 1938, though there seems to be no information about his early childhood available. However, in court documents and records, there seems to be no indication that his childhood was anything less than stable. What we know is that John revered his father, often talking about him in his later years, saying that his father was his hero and credits him for instilling in him a love for the outdoors. John was a 27-year-old father of two in 1966. He was a math teacher at Du Bois High School and was well-liked amongst most of his students. In April of that year, he was waiting for the school year to come to a close so he could attend a summer fellowship in Montana. Du Bois, Pennsylvania is a small city that thrived on mining and steel mills. In 1960, only 10,000 people lived in the city. That number has since dwindled to less than 8,000 in 2016. Like most small towns in the United States, everyone seems to know everyone. This was the case with John. He was known as a math whiz, very intellectual, but one student was not particularly fond of her math teacher. Pamela Sue Reimer was an 18-year-old honor student who attended Du Bois High School. She was an avid horse lover who enjoyed riding. She played the clarinet in her high school band and had just purchased her prom dress. She was very excited to end her senior year. She was a student of John's, but she just couldn't stand him. She got an eerie feeling from him and even asked her mother if she could withdraw from his class. When her mother asked why, she said, "Oh, Mom, you should see his eyes." Something about John was making Pamela uneasy. She was unable to withdraw from his class and decided to just suck it up. After all, in the fall, she was headed to Penn State University on a scholarship. She thought she had the next chapter of her life, all planned. It was a dreary and drizzly day on April 28, 1966. John was surveying land to purchase. He noticed Pamela, who was walking home from the bus stop. He pulled up next to her and offered to give her a ride home. Her gut likely told her to refuse, but she got inside the vehicle. They drove slowly along the countryside as John remarked that he was looking for an old farmhouse to purchase. They continued making small talk and Pamela settled into her seat as they neared her home. Then, John asked her if she would be willing to show him where some of the farmhouses were. This proposition spooked Pamela, and she asked John to stop the car and let her out. She began to pull on the handle to escape, but John had pulled on her sleeve. He did this to try and clear up any misunderstanding. She felt him pull her sleeve, and she immediately hit him with her umbrella. She began screaming for him to let her out of the car. John was infuriated by her inability to calm down, so he reached in his back seat and got a wrench. He hit her over the head with a wrench, and Pamela, finally able to escape the car, began to stagger up the road as fast as she could. John parked his vehicle and got out to run after her. His memory of what happened next is hazy, but he believed he strangled her with her own stocking, beat her about the head with a wrench, and slit her throat. There is speculation that he raped Pamela, but it was later confirmed via her autopsy that she was not sexually assaulted. In the small community of Du Bois, the rumor that he raped Pamela persisted, even to this day. Her body was discovered later that evening, and just like that, Pamela's hopes for her future were dashed the moment she accepted a ride from someone she should have been able to trust. John immediately burned the clothing he was wearing, changed his outfit, and collected his children from the babysitter. He replayed the events in his mind. What made him snap? Did he lose his mind in that moment? He wasn't sure and likely began to regret his actions. Whatever the reason, at 5:45 a.m. on April 29th, 1966, John Yount turned himself into authorities. He provided a written confession and was arrested for the murder of 18-year-old Pamela Sue Reimer. Pamela Sue Reimer's autopsy confirmed that her cause of death was a result of strangulation. Each time Pamela drew in a breath, blood seeped into her lungs and suffocated her to death. John's trial took place in October of 1966, and he took the stand in his own defense. He told the jury that he was temporarily insane when he murdered Pamela. The jury didn't believe him and found him guilty of first-degree murder and rape. The judge in his trial sentenced him to life in prison. John immediately appealed his sentence. His attorneys found that detectives did not properly Mirandize him when he provided his initial confession. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court overturned the verdict and remanded a new trial. In 1970, John was again before a 12-panel jury. The written confession that he provided in 1966 was suppressed and the rape charge was dismissed due to the autopsy findings. On November 4th, 1970, jury selection began and John requested a change of venue. His defense team argued that there had been too much media attention brought to the case and that the potential jury pool was tainted. The motions for a new venue were denied, and after 10 days of voir dire, the trial began. His second trial would take on a much more different tone than the first. He opted not to take the stand in his own defense and instead focused on the intent behind the murder. John claims that he had no intention of murdering Pamela that day. Instead, he got caught up in the heat of the moment and, in an act of self-perseverance, took her life. He hoped that by having character witnesses and attacking the idea of intent, he would be successful in being charged with a lesser degree of murder. The jury deliberated and again found him guilty of first-degree murder. He was resentenced to life in prison. His attorneys motioned for a new trial but were ultimately denied. John was set to spend the rest of his life in prison. He filed another appeal to have his conviction overturned due to the denial of the venue change. He claimed that the media coverage negatively impacted the jury pool, but his appeal was denied by the Supreme Court. John would be up for review over the next 9 years, but would be denied parole. After 20 years behind bars, he finally had enough. Although he was a model prisoner throughout those 20 years, he knew he would never get out of prison without his sentence being commuted. Despite the numerous recommendations, he was denied each time. By 1982, John had learned computer programming, taught other inmates, and even traveled through the prison system playing the organ for the church choir. He also began a pen pal relationship with 43-year-old married mother of two, Diane Broadbeck. Diane's friend had been unable to keep up with the demand of John's letters and asked if Diane would write to him instead. Diane realized that John's facility was rather close to her and decided to visit him in person. The visits and letters created an emotional attachment for the pair, and soon, their letters took on a sexual tone. When John was transferred to Rockview Correctional Institute, Diane made the two-hour drive from her home in Wellsville, Pennsylvania. In 1985, John and Diane's relationship escalated. She had John send the letters he wrote to a P.O. box in a town over. She purchased the box using her middle and maiden name, Brenda Warner. When she visited John at the prison, they would spend the full four-hour allotment holding hands, whispering in each other's ears, kissing, and hugging. Guards came to know her well as she visited him weekly. John made Diane feel needed. Her children no longer needed her, and her husband no longer showed her the love and affection she desired. She craved romance, and John was the man to provide it to her. In the winter of 1985, John petitioned for the third and final time to have a new trial. His request was denied, and John knew he was never going to regain his freedom through appeal. He requested to be transferred to a new work detail. John was permitted to work the unsupervised farm detail due to his good behavior. He revealed his plan to Diane during one of her visits to the prison and in several letters afterwards. He told her that after 20-plus years behind bars, he had atoned for what he did to Pamela. If the state of Pennsylvania wasn't going to give him his freedom, then he had to take it for himself. This was the moment Diane could have chosen to walk away or report John's plan of escape. Instead, she promised she would help him. She just needed time to get some items in order. Diane set up a secret savings account and even purchased a vehicle that she stored in a storage room near the prison. She saved up over $7,000 and informed John that she was as ready as she could be. John was ecstatic to hear Diane was ready to leave Pennsylvania behind. They were going to be so happy and finally have the love and freedom they both desired. On April 5th, 1986, John was working his farm detail as expected. He was responsible for transporting inmates to their work locations and was expected to return back to his area to cut hay. He dropped the others off in their respective locations and made his way back to his detail. A corrections officer, on his way to the bowling alley that afternoon, happened to see Diane driving towards the prison. He knew that she was John's girlfriend and figured it was time for her weekly visit. He thought nothing more of what he saw until later that evening. Earlier that day, Diane informed her husband, Chester, that she was headed to Williamsburg, Virginia. The pair drove down 20 miles to a hotel where the car she stored away was waiting for her. They swapped cars and continued driving west. They weren't sure where they would land, but knew they needed to be as far away from Pennsylvania as possible. When John failed to report back to his detail, guards at the minimum security prison conducted a search of the immediate area, hoping to find a trace of him. When the prison guard, who saw Diane the previous day, heard of John's escape, he shared that he had seen Diane Broadbeck heading towards the prison grounds around the early afternoon. The authorities were informed of Diane's alleged involvement in the escape and went to her home to question her family. Chester was shocked to see authorities knocking on his door and questioning him on the whereabouts of his wife and her relationship with a prisoner. Chester shared that she was in Virginia for the weekend and was due back on Monday for work. He claimed to have no knowledge of a relationship between John and Diane. Chester was in for a rude awakening. Over the course of the next month, the secret life Diane had been leading would be revealed. In May of 1986, Diane's abandoned car, along with her personal items, were discovered in the motel parking lot. Diane's family was worried about her safety. When they realized the crime John committed in 1966, they surmised that John had brainwashed Diane and was likely going to murder her. Chester refused to believe the alternative and was convinced that his wife was not in love with John. After the discovery of her vehicle, the case went cold. By then, John and Diane arrived at Boise, Idaho. After the discovery of her vehicle, the case went cold. By then, John and Diane arrived to Boise, Idaho. They took on new identities and worked odd jobs until they could find more stable employment. They kept a relatively low profile. Diane, now known as Kathy Kerman, and John, now known as Jim Forsgren. Kathy gained employment as a bank manager, and Jim got a job as a computer programmer. This was the late 80s, so changing your identity was much easier than it is today. They lived in a small basement apartment in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Kathy and Jim ran into no trouble. They believed their simple existence was going to be this way forever. On May 18, 1988, their little secret would be revealed on national television. Unsolved Mysteries aired their story, and people began looking at their neighbors a little more closely. One man in particular, Don Humphrey, was an avid watcher of the show. When he saw Diane's photo come across the screen, he thought she bared an uncanny resemblance to his co-worker, Kathy Kerman. He went to work the next day, looked at Kathy a little more closely, and felt sure that his suspicion was correct. When he arrived home, he phoned into the tip line and informed the show that he believed Diane Broadbeck was his co-worker. The show passed along the information to Pennsylvanian authorities. They didn't immediately vet the tip as they had numerous tips pour in that night. Diane and John were none the wiser and continued to live their life. When authorities finally reached the tip offered by Don, they flew to Coeur d'Alene. When they presented photos of Diane Broadbeck to her boss, he confirmed that the woman in the photo was Kathy Kerman. They requested the address of where she was living and waited until both Diane and John were observed going into the home. They surrounded the home with the help of the local police department and arrested Diane and John without incident. Diane and John were brought back to Centre County, Pennsylvania, to answer to the felony charges of hindering prosecution, aiding in the consumption of a crime, and escape. Chester reunited with his wife, and she expressed remorse for her role in helping John escape. John wasn't as repentant of his escape as Diane was. He told local reporters, quote, "After 20 years, I felt I had paid my debt, and if I was able to capture any meaning to the rest of my life, it was necessary." Diane's attorney, Terrence McGowan, issued a statement to the media saying, "She looks back now and she says, how could I have been so stupid? She basically realizes she made a big mistake and wants to put this whole phase of her life behind her." Terrence was able to negotiate a plea deal for Diane. Prosecutors agreed to drop all but the conspiracy charge if she pled guilty. On December 6, 1988, she pled guilty and posted a $250,000 bail while awaiting her sentencing. John was also able to negotiate a plea deal and pled guilty to escape. 7 additional years were added to his life sentence. Diane was eventually sentenced to 2 years in prison. When she was released, she returned to her husband Chester. Many people were shocked that Chester took Diane back, but ultimately, he held on to the notion that Diane had no real idea of the atrocious crime John committed and that she had been brainwashed by him. John spent the remainder of his years as a prison advocate and lawyer. He continued to request a commutation of his sentence, but would be continuously denied. He would maintain his model prisoner status until his suicide in 2012. Diane disappeared into obscurity. We do know that Chester, unfortunately, passed away in 1995. Where she currently resides is unknown. Her adult children have a limited social media presence. Pamela Reimer's mom, LaVon, who lived in fear the 2 years John and Diane were living in Idaho, experienced countless tragedies before and after Pamela's death. She lost her son in a tragic accident in 1963. Pamela in 1966, and her husband to what she attributes to a broken heart in 1976. LaVon passed away in 2010 after a short illness. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Diane's story made me question, what makes a woman want to help a man escape from prison? Is she missing something in her life like Diane said she was? Did the attention, affection, and promises of love bestowed upon them cause them to cast their better judgment aside?
I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor.
Joyce Mitchell was born on March 23, 1964. Joyce and Toby Primo divorced in 1995 due to Joyce's multiple affairs. One of the men she slept with was Lyle Mitchell. The two met at the True Stitch slipper factory where they both worked. Their affair came to light after they were caught having sex on the railroad tracks outside of the factory. After her divorce from Toby, Joyce would go on to marry Lyle. She began a new life with him and her young son. After their marriage, Joyce and Lyle moved on from the slipper factory and began working at Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York. Lyle worked as an industrial training supervisor and Joyce as a tailor shop instructor. It was here that Joyce met Richard Matt and David Sweat. Richard was serving 25 years to life for the 1997 kidnap, torture, and murder of his former boss, whose body was found in pieces in a river. David was serving life without parole for his part in the 2002 killing of Sheriff's Deputy Kevin Tarsia. Kevin was shot 15 times and then run over after he caught David and two accomplices with a stolen gun. Joyce began a relationship with David. In her official confession, she denies the two had a sexual relationship, but this is disputed by multiple inmates who saw the two disappear into a storage closet together several times for about 15 minutes. The prison eventually got wind of the rumors and began an investigation on the relationship between Joyce and David. While they could not find proof of a sexual relationship, they did move David out of her tailor shop and into another one. Joyce also had a sexual relationship with Richard, but claims that it was more forced upon her. In her confession, Joyce stated that Richard forced her to perform oral sex on him and also to aggressively grab his penis. While Joyce found the sexual advances unwanted, she did claim that Richard made her feel special. He asked her to contact his daughter for him, which was a major violation of prison rules. Joyce made contact with Richard's daughter in spite of this. Richard then asked Joyce to bring him some hacksaws. Joyce thought they would be used to make frames and thought nothing of it. She bought the hacksaws and smuggled them in. It wasn't until later, she claimed, that she found out the hacksaw, along with other tools she would bring, were being used to dig a hole out of the prison for Richard and David to escape. Upon learning this, not only did Joyce not tell prison authorities of the escape plan, but she agreed to help them. On the day of the escape, Joyce was to meet Richard and David at a manhole outside of prison. She would pick them up and drive them to an undisclosed location about 7 hours away from the prison. There wasn't much of a plan after that, other than the three of them would live happily ever after. Only their new life couldn't start until after Joyce's husband was killed. Richard gave Joyce two pills and instructed her to give them to her husband so he would go unconscious. Then he would be murdered by Richard and David. It was supposedly the plan to kill her husband that made Joyce ultimately back out from helping the two convicts escape. On June 6, 2015, the day of the escape, Joyce was nowhere to be found once Richard and David were outside the prison walls. Instead, she was at the hospital with complaints of chest pains. This kink in their plan did not stop them, and they would eventually lead several law enforcement agencies on a long and expensive manhunt. It was on June 7, 2015, at 5:17 a.m., during the morning headcount, that Richard Matt and David Sweat were discovered to be missing. When their beds were checked, prison guards found that their beds had been stuffed with clothes in order to look like someone was sleeping. They also found a note that said, "Have a nice day." Prison authorities found the hole that was dug and alerted local authorities to the prison escape. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo ordered a 200-person manhunt and offered a $100,000 reward for aid in capture. The next day, on June 8th, guards surmised that the prisoners had to have had inside help in order to make their escape. After looking into their files, authorities brought in Joyce Mitchell as a person of interest. It didn't take long for Joyce to crack and cooperate fully with authorities. She signed a full confession, admitting to her part in the escape. While she did give authorities a good insight into the escape plan, it would still be a long time before either man was found. The longer the search went on, the amount of agencies involved increased. Eventually, along with the local police and prison authorities, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the FBI, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the ATF, U.S. Marshals, and the New York State Forest Rangers assisted in trying to locate the escaped convicts. On June 26, 20 days after their escape, Richard Matt was found in Franklin County, New York. He was spotted after he shot a 20-gauge shotgun at a driver of a passing recreational vehicle. When confronted by authorities, a firefight broke out and Richard Matt was shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol. On June 28th, David Sweat was spotted in a field near Constable, New York. He was shot twice by a New York State trooper but survived his injuries. He would spend a week in the hospital before being transferred to the special housing unit at Five Points Correctional Facility in Romulus, New York, a maximum security prison. David Sweat pled guilty to 2 felony counts of first-degree escape and promoting prison contraband. He was sentenced to 3.5 to 7 years to be served consecutively with his life sentence. After initially pleading not guilty, Joyce Mitchell would plead guilty to promoting prison contraband and criminal facilitation. She was sentenced to 2.5 to 7 years in prison. Her most recent parole hearing in 2017 was denied. Lyle Mitchell has stayed with his wife and was interviewed after her parole hearing in 2017. He told the media that he was angry about the time in prison his wife had to spend, and all he wanted was for her to come home. So, what do you think caused these women to risk their lives and leave their families? Share your thoughts with us in the Facebook discussion group. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and positively review the show on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request or a general suggestion, send us an email, tcfcpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or wetalkofdreams.com. Research assistance, content editing, and writing assistance for the show was provided by Brittany Martinez. Audio engineering was provided by Ches Gray, who manages Ches Gray Music.